Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone, and welcome to the 468th edition of the Feuerstein's Fire American Soccer Show. I'm your host, Daniel Feuerstein. I'll give you American perspective on clubs, leagues, players, national team, and other fabulous moments. You get your daily reading from me and other writers over at Once a Metro and the rest of the SB Nation family of soccer websites. Come on in. Chat room is open. If you have a question for me, I'll try to answer to the best of my abilities. As we continue to honor and remember the 25 years of Major League Soccer, as we talk about those players, once again, we talk about those that also cover the sport in the United States and have also broadcasted in the United States for their clubs. I'm very happy to have join me tonight. For 25 years, he has been the television play-by-play voice of the Columbus Crew, a gentleman that I have heard through highlights, of course, but you know what? This man has been through plenty of wonderful years in Columbus Crew soccer history. The one and the only Dwight Burgess joins me tonight. Dwight, welcome to the show. I hope you and your family are safe through this pandemic at the moment, but may I say, I know this is the first year now you're no longer a part of Columbus Crew broadcasting. Still, it must have been a hell of a ride for you, 25 years to see this league and the Columbus Crew become life and then part of this entire life that we call soccer.
If you are satisfied with your message, press 1 to listen to your message.
Yep. And unfortunately, we didn't have him there. I thought we did. Let's try that again. Let's see if we can get him again. Thought we had him, but I guess not. So let's see if we have him on again here. Let's
Four,
see. Second
two,
time is
seven,
the charm.
Five.
Nope. And we're going to try again to see if he is available. But, you know, Dwight Burgess, ladies and gentlemen, a gentleman is very, very talented, a broadcaster that has been around for a long, long time, and hopefully we'll get him on. And now we were on conversation that he would come on, and we're going to try again to get him on here, trying to talk to him and, you know, get his want to see what we can talk about. You know, the Columbus Crew, once again, a lot of once again, we're going to try and get him on as much as we can here, trying to hopefully see if we can get him on now here. Let's see. And maybe we have him on now. Mr. Burgess, are you available, sir? And it looks like we don't know if we have him on or not. Hello? Mr. Burgess, are you there? Because we know we got your Columbus Crew fans here wanting to hear from you. And at the moment, it looks like he's not there. We're going to try and get him on as much as we can and try to, you know, keep talking with him and try and get in touch with him and Okay, so we are having phone issues, ladies and gentlemen. I'm getting in touch with him. And this is what happens sometimes on a live streaming show. And hopefully we get him on. And if not, then hopefully we'll try to do it a different way. Mr. Burgess, are you there now? All right. So Blog Talk Radio is having issues, so we're going to try to do it a different way. So here we go, ladies and gentlemen. We're going to try and do it a different way here because at the moment we're having some issues with the phones. So I'm going to try a different phone number. So hang on 1 second. And we're going to try a different way here. And hopefully everyone can hear him. And let's see what happens now. Okay. He is talking to me on the cell phone here, on text messaging. Let me see if we can get him on this. We're having issues here with the phone, unfortunately. There's a lot of phone issues here, unfortunately. We're trying to get him on. He knows. He's aware. Of course, Dwight Burgess spending 25 years as the play-by-play voice of the Columbus Crew. And I don't understand why we're having phone issues here. We're trying to get him on. Let's see here. Mr. Burgess, are you there? Ah, there we go. Great. I don't know why we're having issues with the phones here at the moment, but thankfully we have you on, and thank you once again for joining me. As I was trying to give you the best introduction you've ever had, we're gonna try this again. 25 years as broadcaster of the Columbus Crew, you have seen a lot of soccer, you've seen a lot of Columbus Crew history. And you've called it a career at the end of 2019. It must have been bittersweet to put the microphone down and say, that's it, I'm done.
Having me on, I don't get too many opportunities like this these days. I do miss it, and so I appreciate it. And whatever was happening electronically, I'm glad you had stuck with it. Maybe it's just because of my advanced age, so the phone just didn't want to cooperate, but... yeah, it's been incredibly difficult. I think, in fairness, I should say that the decision to step down was predicated upon some significant health issues that I've been having, and in particular, a stroke. So I hope perhaps one day that I might be able to return. Certainly the Crew, we left it open. I don't know. But I'm lucky, you know, for a lot of years, I had one of 10 jobs in the country, and... and I'm going to take pride in that.
Absolutely. And, you know, back in the day, when the World Cup came in 1994 to the United States, you know, I have to ask this question. And the question simply is this, is that did you expect and hoped that a Division I league would be coming to our shores? Obviously, Major League Soccer came 2 years later, but still, though – you know, did you expect something big to happen, and did you expect Columbus to be a part of this?
Well, certainly I expected the league to come in because that was part of the agreement between the Federation and FIFA, was that in order to have the World Cup here, they had to guarantee that there would be a Division I league. I certainly wish it would have happened sooner. Whether or not I had the talent, I don't know, but, you know, you played through college as I did, and there was no place to go. So I would have loved to have had at least an opportunity much earlier than we did. As for the rest of it, no, I had no expectation that Columbus would get a team, let alone would be the first to reach that 10,000 season ticket mark. And when the league opened, I was certainly cautiously optimistic. There were plenty of reasons to not talk about year two or year three. It was just getting through 1 week and 1 month of the first season to keep that thing going.
Yeah, I agree with you there. What made you get into broadcasting, and why did you fall in love with the game?
You know, I'm a traditionalist in that respect, and again, I'm going to show my advanced age here, but, you know, for whatever reason, you know, I grew up and I had that transistor radio radio, and I would stick it under my pillow at night, and I'd scroll the dial up and down, just, you know, find any sporting event that I could. You know, that day and age, AM radio was still a big deal. You had 50,000 watt stations in Cincinnati and Pittsburgh and in St. Louis and in New York, and at night you could pick those up all over the place. And it was just something that I always enjoyed. And then in college, just the university radio station. And I just started goofing around doing it and did a little bit of football, a little bit of basketball. Students just took turns, but found that I really liked it. And so once I got to the end of my bachelor's work, I knew I wanted to stay in the game, and I knew that I enjoyed the broadcast piece. And over time, as the professional indoor game began to grow, there was a team in Dayton, Ohio, and then eventually in Cincinnati, Ohio, and even for a short time in Columbus. And they wanted to do a broadcast thing, and they were looking for somebody that had the combination of broadcasting experience and soccer background. I had plenty of soccer background. I had a limited broadcasting background, but they hired me, and off it went from there.
And from that point on, obviously, 25 years of career, calling all these games for the Columbus Crew, either at the time you were at the Ohio State football stadium until finally, thank goodness for Lamar Hunt, building the first ever MLS soccer-specific stadium, which, of course, Crew Stadium, now Mopry Stadium, even though I'll still call it Crew Stadium because, you know, that's the original home of the Columbus Crew. What was it about that opening year to see players like Robert Warzyha and Brian McBride, Mike Lapper, I mean, you know, just doing wonderful things with the soccer ball over at the Ohio State University football stadium?
You asked a great question. It can be answered in so many different ways. But, they only sold tickets in the lower bowl at that time, and the entire lower bowl for the first few games was sold out. So that was amazing to be sitting up in the press box at the stadium overlooking this was surreal. Of course, nobody knew much about anybody at that point in time from a college soccer perspective. The first big name for Columbus outside the U.S. players like McBride was Dr. Kamalo from South Africa. And in 1995, he was named South Africa's player of the decade, even though the decade was only half over. So Dr. Kamalo comes in, and then Brian McBride bursts on the scene. You've got multiple IU guys. A guy that a lot of people don't realize, Janosch Mahalik, who does a lot of that international stuff, you know, for ESPN. Janosch Mahalik played, you know, for Columbus. Brian Bliss was there. Then Brad Friedel eventually came in. So it was a combination of the excitement. I think the fact that we were on campus really helped because they did special things with the students. And they could literally just walk over to the stadium 45 minutes, halftime 45 minutes, and off with their Saturday night. So I think ultimately it was a culmination of all of those pieces with the surreal element of, man, is this really happening? And is it really happening in Columbus, Ohio?
Talking about some of those teams, I mean, you know, a bunch of players have worn the black and gold. A couple of brilliant managers have been running these Crew sides. I mean, none bigger than Ziggy Schmidt, of course, at that time for the Crew to finally win an MLS Cup championship. What was it about Ziggy that unfortunately no longer with us, but what was it about Schmidt that, you know, you were so intrigued by him and how meticulous he is with tactics and formations?
You know, he was, in a manner of speaking, very much a player's coach. He had a mind. He knew what he wanted. He had high expectations. And if the guys didn't meet him, they heard about it. On the other side, if the guys were showing up, they were working as professionals and trying to, you know, implement what he asked them to do, he always had their back. Always had their back. I was one of the first people that he wanted to talk to when he took the job. He didn't know me from Adam, and he wanted to know, you know, kind of my philosophy on calling games. And I said, you know, Ziggy, keep in mind that I'm not creating what happens on the field. I am simply saying what happens on the field. Nobody wants the Crew to be more successful than I do. And I want to be fair, but I want to be fair to the fans. And that means calling the game down the middle as I see it. You coach the way you see it. I call it the way I see it. And as long as we understand that we're going to disagree with each other from time to time, I don't think you'll ever find anything that you would be considering that you would consider to be inappropriate. And that was our relationship from that day forward.
And, you know, which other managers have been very – you've been intrigued with besides Schmidt? I mean, obviously the last one before who the current manager is right now. Right now it just escapes my memory at the
Caleb
moment.
Porter.
Thank you, Caleb Porter. What was Greg Berhalter like when he ran the crew before becoming the U.S. men's national team head coach? What was it about Berhalter that intrigued you? You know, former player – managed a team over in Sweden, and then he comes back to the States, and he just takes over a team where he molds them into the way that he thinks can be a dangerous side for years and years to come.
Well, you know, he wasn't in that initial list of candidates. He really kind of got in a little bit late, but blew everybody away. When you hear them talk about how detailed, how meticulous, to use your word, he is, that is 100% true. He is incredibly organized. He is very much into the data analytics piece of it. And the presentation he made to the ownership just completely blew them away. I like Greg very much. I certainly respect him as a coach. But I'll also tell you that that first season was a tough one. He came in, as you know, back from Europe as a player, as a coach, and had a very European idea of how the team was to be treated. I could no longer, for example, go to practice without his permission in advance. We were very limited on who we could talk with. We couldn't even talk with assistants about different things. And things were coming up, and there's a national team, so we want to do something with Josh Wolf. We couldn't do any of that. So that I didn't care for. But full credit to Greg, as that year passed and we got into year two and he got more comfortable in his role, then that began to change. And for me as a college coach, which is what I do in the other part of my life, watching the way he goes about his job and the way he interacts with players was fascinating to watch. So different than Siggy, Siggy was not as focused on the littlest of details to where Greg was. Siggy had that kind of personality, you know, where he found different ways to connect. Greg predominantly connected with his players on a soccer level, which doesn't mean that he didn't care about them. He does care about them. But his communication was very professional. Siggy's the kind of guy that could tell you a joke and, you know, and those kinds of things. So that was particularly interesting in contrast.
Talking about what's been happening in Columbus, obviously, you know, many, many times, many, many runs in the playoffs, the U.S. Open Cup. Of course, that one year that the crew finally went all the way to win the trophy with Lamar Hunt's name on it, that must have been a wonderful night in Columbus when they finally pulled off that big title long time ago in the early 2000s.
Yeah, 100%. You know, Columbus, well, they were – didn't have a lot of success, even when they were making the playoffs in the early days. You know, they could never get past DC United, but in the early days, nobody ultimately could get past Bruce Arena's team. But they had had success in the Open Cup. They had been to a final, went to Chicago. Frankie Klopas scored a late winner, so they lost by a goal there. They got eliminated in the semifinals the year that Moffray Stadium opened, and hosted the U.S. Open Cup without Columbus Lane in it. It was Rochester and I want to say Colorado off the top of my head.
You are correct.
Hey, how about that? had some great adventures. Twice we were at Virginia Beach to play an Open Cup game, only to have hurricanes come in. The first time we had to evacuate. The second time they moved the game up 24 hours and went ahead and played it, but of course it was in a torrential downpour. Thankfully, the winds and the ocean rise and those kinds of things hadn't occurred yet. So, you know, there's all those wonderful stories, but there's no question between the, you know, the first team, the new stadium, having come close a couple of times, and the thing that remains etched in my mind, and I have a picture of it, is Brian McBride dropping to his knees at the end of that championship game and just tears flowing down his cheeks. And that was something that was so important to him. He wanted to give Columbus some sort of a trophy before he left. He knew more at that stage of his career about his future plans than the public did, but I'll never forget that. Him on his knees just openly weeping. Obviously, in joy over winning the championship, but in what he felt like was an important thing to do for Columbus.
No, I don't blame him. I mean, such rich tradition over in Columbus when it comes to the Crew and American soccer. I mean, how many times have we seen Dos Acero happen at Crew Stadium until, of course, the last World Cup qualifier against Mexico? Before we even get to that last one, you know, the run that U.S. men's national team has had at Crew Stadium, especially the first one when Bruce Arena was getting ready to have the U.S. men's national team prepared against Mexico, the biggest rivals, not just for the United States, but for the entire Confederation of CONCACAF. When that second half began with a great pass by Clint Mathis to Josh Wolf, and then, of course, Wolf crossing it to Ernie Stewart to cap off that famed scoreline, in your mind, you know, was this like an adventure for you to see this happen in front of your eyes?
Yeah, absolutely it was. It was just incredible. And I think the history of that, and I know you're familiar with all of this, but, you know, even prior to 94 and then after 94, and then, of course, the debacle in the 98 World Cup, getting people to go to games in the U.S. was still not a big deal. And when they played them in L.A. and those types of places, of course, as we know, particularly in Mexico, there was a very large Hispanic, you know, contingent. So the whole idea by coming to Monterrey, which had to have been sold pretty hard, as you can imagine, was we need to get as close as we can to a guaranteed pro-American crowd. We play in a small stadium where we have direct control of the tickets, and we play in the middle of the winter, and then everybody kind of held their fingers tight, crossed their fingers and hopes. And, you know, it came across better than anybody could have hoped. To be the spotlight of the soccer world from a U.S.-Mexico perspective was never lost on this community. It was very well received, a lot of support, ancillary activities, you know, making sure that people were safe, getting in and out of the stadium, the things people don't generally talk about. But the atmosphere, you know, until you've been in it, you can't really describe it. But there's been a lot of pride in this city about this is our little piece of the pie, and we're darn proud of it, and we're going to make it be the best thing we possibly can. And, you know, the first one, when the game time temperature was 28 degrees, literally, Mexico didn't come out of the locker room until the game started. They did no warm-up on the field. They didn't come out until they had to kick off, and off it went. They wanted no business of playing there in that sort of weather.
It must have been fun to see the, as I call it, the pilgrimage to Columbus, whenever it's a final round, a hex round of qualifying. That comes before hopefully it leads to qualification to the World Cup or the start of qualification to the World Cup. That must have been interesting to see almost a lot of Americans, not just locals in Columbus and Ohio, but, you know, close to maybe representing every state in the union of the country to come see these games being played.
You know, Columbus isn't New York or Chicago or Dallas or San Francisco. You know, it's very much a Midwestern town, Indianapolis. You know, the history of Pittsburgh is different, but these days Pittsburgh got a lot more in common with Columbus and Indianapolis than it does, you know, the old, you know, steel cities and the rest of it. So I do agree with you. I do think that this was a little bit of it's our home. Obviously, you had the educational piece. People, you know, the average sports fan didn't know what the hex was. Why is this such a big deal? And there was really a concerted effort made between the Crew and U.S. Soccer to provide clinics and activities and presentations, you know, to really make available information and education to help the local community better understand the importance of this. And then the Chamber of Commerce and the Columbus Sports Commission and these local groups got involved to make the people coming in from outside feel as welcome as possible. And, you know, I just think it was the coming together of a variety of things, as it is wont to do from time to time in life, where it just came together and was even bigger and better than people had hoped. We don't see that enough, and we're certainly glad it happened here.
Absolutely. Going back to your career, how many analysts have you had I know one has been a Bill McDermott. I know he's in St. Louis right now. When MLS started with ESPN, he was the third man with the Phil Shane and Ty Keogh, who are in the booth above. What was Bill like? And any other analysts that you remember in your career, who were the best, who were the funniest, and maybe who are the ones who are like, oh, God, let me get out of here, please.
Sure. So just to run through the list real quickly, my first partner with the crew was Dr. Jay Martin. Jay is the winningest, has the highest winning percentage in NCAA history, college soccer, regardless of division or gender. He's a Division III coach at Ohio Wesleyan. The dude's won over 700 college games.
Oh, my God.
From New England, Springfield College guy, and still there. I tease him all the time because as best he can remember, he's I'm like Loch Ness Monster old, but he's like pterodactyl old. And he is actually Ohio Wesleyan's in our conference. So, you know, we play each year. So the last time we went up there, they have named the stadium after him. And when I saw him, I said, Jay, when'd you die? I thought, all crotchety the way he is at this stage of his career. And I said, well, they name stuff after people after they die. So Jay was a great guy. And he was, you know, those first couple of years we predominantly did radio. There really was very little regional television. So painting the picture, but he had a level of experience and expertise and is a real disciple of the German game. So when Siggy came in, even though Jay wasn't broadcast anymore, they connected quite a bit. On the television side, I have worked with a number of people over the years, in addition to being with the crew regularly. I filled in on some Chicago Fire games, did some Kansas City playoff games with Bill. Bill is one of the greatest human beings I have ever met in my life. He's a dear friend. We stay in touch. Couldn't be happier for him that St. Louis is going to have a team. I mean, he is St. Louis soccer. You can't talk to anybody about soccer in St. Louis without them knowing Bill McDermott. And I'll be honest with you, I thought it was really a shame what happened to him because, as you pointed out, he was the sideline guy early. He did a couple of World Cups with J.P. Della Camera from ABC and suddenly just disappeared, and it was our great benefit. And, you know, he would come in from St. Louis for the games, and we became very, very close. But his knowledge of the game, you know, when he played for St. Louis, they won a national championship at Spartan Stadium in San Jose. So each and every time, year after year, we went to Spartan Stadium to play San Jose, he would make me come early so he could take me out on the field and show me where he took the free kick that led to the goal to win the national championship every freaking time. I look forward to hearing Bill again, you know, when St. Louis, joins the league and starts playing officially, I should say. Beyond that, then we went to player route. Then there were enough years with Dante Washington. Was with me for several years. Dante was great. He never quite got fully comfortable in front of the camera when we were doing the stand-up, pregame, halftime, and so forth. But his knowledge of the game and when we were in the game, his ability to identify what was happening, what wasn't happening, you know, as the analyst, was fabulous. And, of course, now he's high up in the crew organization working on a number of things. So when he moved on, then Duncan Outen became my partner. And the big thing I remember about Duncan is being from New Zealand. He said, look, Dwight, you speak American. I speak English. So we used to talk about that. But again, like Dante, he was able to provide this player perspective, which was great. Then the last, as the play-by-play guy, the last partner I had on a regular basis was Chris Dorn. Chris was a Bloomington, Indiana guy, an IU guy, did and still does a lot of Big Ten soccer. Did some stuff for the Chicago Fire for a while, then came over and was the analyst, and then moved to the studio host, and now he's the radio guy for the crew and still there. Then the last person I work with is the current play-by-play guy, Neil Sika. Neil was the radio guy for a number of years, and then when the prior ownership took over, they decided to go to the simulcast set. So rather than having a broadcast the TV broadcast team and a radio broadcast team, they just took Neil and put us together. In the first couple of years, we rotated chairs. And then they decided, since I had the soccer background, that it would make more sense for me to become the analyst and Neil the play-by-play guy. So, you know, Neil and I have got to be very close. He actually just called today. I got to call him back. and working with him and kind of being then, the, you know, sort of the dad of the relationship and trying to help him bring along. And, you know, now he's got his own career with the crew. He's done some stuff with ESPN. That's the other thing I would say. I know I'm rambling a little bit here. I apologize for that. But Katie Witham, who's, you know, does the sideline stuff. Katie started, I helped her get her first job as a grad assistant, if you will, intern with the crew. And then she started doing some stuff with the crew and eventually, but she also played for me for, I was head women's coach in college for 8 years. So she's actually a former player of mine. Then came Ashley Agnelzi. She's out in LA now. Alex Steck was with us. She's now the digital person for FC Cincinnati. And Marissa Capitelli from Cleveland, she was another one. She's now the digital person for the Cincinnati Bengals. So, I've enjoyed that. You know, some people that helped me in the early days get my first opportunity and to have been able to play some small role in helping others grow their careers has been quite satisfying.
Out of all the games you've called, whether it be on radio or television, which ones do you remember were the best games you've called?
Well, I think anything from 1996, because the challenges were so great. Going to RFK Stadium, and what at that time, because the Redskins were still playing there, was the NFL with the film, not the broadcast, but the actual team film. In the old days, with the teams would film the game, and they would break down film. Well, it's at the very top of the stadium. That was the radio broadcast booth. But they didn't sell any tickets in the upper deck. So I'd do the long walk to get up there, but you talk about atmosphere or lack thereof. You had the rats running around underneath RFK Stadium where we would park in the locker rooms and stuff. Then they brought it the cats, and they got a population of feral cats eating the rats, and so you're dodging those things. You're sitting up in the flight pattern for Ronald Reagan International Airport and completely disconnected from the field. That was crazy. We had an afternoon game, a weekday afternoon game in Kansas City at Arrowhead where they brought in all the public school kids, and there were like 2,000 kids there, which was great, but there was 88,000 or whatever the number is, you know, empty seats. So everything was an adventure. The stadiums, the personnel, nobody really quite understood what soccer was all about. And the challenges, you know, that we faced just to try and get a broadcast on the air would be unthinkable nowadays. But there was just one adventure after another. Beyond that, obviously the championships you never forget. The Open Cup, MLS Cup, what a great moment that was. There's certainly been some lean times. The last game for Brad Friedel, the last game for Brian McBride. The most difficult part is, as you know, when it's the final game of a beloved player, but you don't know it's the final game for that beloved player. Federico Higuain misses because of the injury and then ends up signing with DC United, never really got a send-off from the fans. So it's hard not to think back to all the championship moments, but I remember having an early season game in Colorado, and it was 28 degrees, and we're in the team hotel, and there's Preki out there in the outdoor pool swimming laps, getting himself loosened up, ready to go. It's 28 degrees. I don't even know how there was water and not ice in the pool, but somehow or another, they made it work. I was doing radio there, went to the restroom, metal door, and when I came back from the restroom while in a commercial break, the metal door had, because of the cold, adhered to the metal frame. I had to go down the walkway in Old Mile High, find an open booth, and then go out, climb out the window, and then shinny my way back to climb in the window at my booth. Right? I mean, where do you get stories like that?
That's unbelievable. That's great. And by the way, it's not just rats at DC. It's also raccoons. I don't know if you've heard those stories, but yeah. And they're still residing because RFK is still up, but thank God for Audi Field. When, Lamar Hunt finally built Crew Stadium, Mopfrey Stadium, and he finally built it, well, in your mind, did that legitimize not just the league, but it legitimized the Columbus Crew in Columbus itself?
100%. Here's a very quick fact for you, and we all understand different times, completely different cities, but they spent about $30 million to build Crew Stadium. They spent $300 million on LAFC Stadium. So while it's not a perfect translation, it gives you a sense. And much of the $30 million going into building Crew Stadium was because they only had 9 months to build it. So they had to pay so many workers and so much overtime because there wasn't any place else they could go. So they had to get it done. And, you know, as it just the thought came to me one day, and it kind of stuck. I called it our lovable little erector set because that's really kind of what it is. It's just lots of aluminum and metal pieces kind of stuck together. But without that stadium, it's highly likely that this league would still not be here. It was that important. Heading into 1999, 2000, in that era, you know, Tampa had dropped out of the league, so and Miami drops out. There was a real concern, and although you may not ever be able to get league officials to go on the record, there was a point in time where they were very, and John Marks has actually talked about this quite a bit. There was a time when it was maybe a phone call away from throwing in the towel, and that's why Lamar Hunt owned for a period of time three teams, and Phil Anschutz owned, what, five teams at one point. The two of them propped up the league.
Yeah.
When Crew Stadium opened, it wasn't just about a soccer-specific stadium, but they finally began to see the potential revenue streams. Because remember, in 99, while there were suites and things, it's not the way it is today. And so they began to do that. They started hosting non-soccer events, the Mid-American Conference Football Championship at one point, which is now played, you know, the Dome in Detroit. That was at the stadium there. There were youth, and I remember calling a game on the early days of the internet when the USU-17s, when it was Landon Donovan and Kyle Beckerman and all of those guys. They began to find real uses, and then, of course, Anschutz then started his own, when they made the decision to build the Galaxy Stadium, started his own production company, but, you know, specializing in concerts, and I've just drawn blank on the word, but he had these stadiums now where he could set up, you know, as concert venues. So that's really what Crew Stadium meant to this league, is it proved that even soccer could be profitable in this country, and then things just took off from there.
Yeah, and that's just wonderful things. Now, of course, we get to the sad part, of course, and that is your feelings about at the time when there was a threat that the Columbus Crew were going to be moved to Austin, Texas. And while thank God that that did not happen, what was your personal emotional feelings for that? Because, I mean, we all know how everyone in Columbus felt. We all know the situation that was going on. There was a threat that an original team was of MLS, a founding member of the league, was moving to a different part of the country. And, you know, everyone in Columbus, including everyone around the league, were like, no, you can't do this. You can't move this team away from where it was born. I mean, what was your personal feelings about this?
Well, obviously, on a personal level, it was devastating for many different reasons. You know, I feel like, and I take a great deal of pride in this, in that, you know, Pete Edwards, who's now an owner, you know, he and I were the only two guys that had been there since day one. So, you know, I felt a particular attachment to it. So every possible emotion you can imagine was wrapped up in it. At the same time, I still had a job to do as a broadcaster, and it's not my private pulpit. I don't just get to, you know, use it to say whatever I want. So I had to be respectful of the team and the broadcast and my responsibility. And I will also say that my relationship with the owner and with the you know, the president, Andy Lockney, was very good. I ran into, after that big upset win over Atlanta in penalties in the playoffs when Zach Steffen came up huge, you know, stopping a couple of PKs, I ran into Anthony Precourt after the game when underneath the stadium, because I was heading toward the locker room. And we talked for a few minutes and had a very pleasant conversation. For him, it was nothing but a business transaction. But he hadn't been there long enough, didn't really understand the emotional connection that the organization had, not only the community, but what it had meant to the league in terms of being the first team, having over 10,000 season tickets and building the stadium, you know, that there were all these other threads. And I think there's a difference between stupidity and ignorance. He just didn't understand, truly did not understand. And I'm not going to be the defender of the organization or what they try to do. As I said to people when they would ask me, look, this is a business, and he owns it, and he can do what he wants. What was really interesting was the way the international players responded, because this doesn't happen. Teams don't, you're right, in the rest of the world, teams don't up and move other places. This Columbus crew, Columbus population relationship is very old school. It's like, you know, I was watching some of the League Two playoff stuff earlier today, and even though there's no fans there right now, you know, it's a little stadium stuck right in the middle of the neighborhood. That's the way it was in Columbus. This was more than just a team. It was part of the fabric of society. So it was very difficult. And because of my years in the league and the people that I've come to know over the years, you know, I had access to information that others didn't, but I always kept my mouth shut and tried to be respectful and very hopeful. And, of course, Pete Edwards and, you know, then the folks with the Browns, you know, came in, and the league was willing to listen, and I give them full credit for that. So I think the bottom line is there were lots of reasons to be upset, legitimate ones, but in the end, the people that needed to step up did so, and things are as good or better than they've ever been. I mean, this new stadium is unbelievable, the kinds of things they have planned for it. So it was tough. You're right, there were plenty around the league that supported us, and we're truly grateful.
I'm also grateful because of the current technology we have. Like YouTube is definitely a wonderful tool to see highlights from past games, and you know, whatever pops up, it does. But when you type in Columbus Crew intro on Fox Sports Ohio, there is you and Neil Sika at the start of the 2019 MLS season, as both of you are in the booth together for the local broadcast. Both of you have hugged each other. Not, you know, not an overwhelming hug, obviously, but, you know, you're grabbing each other. You're hugging each other. You're so happy because the crew are not moving. They are not leaving Columbus. They are staying put. You know, what was that moment for you and Neil just to tell the audience, you know, to open up the 2019 broadcast season that we're here to stay and we're not leaving this great community?
I think it was, you know, the better part of 2 years of anxiousness, of high emotion. And even though Neil, to this point, has not been there quite as many years as I have, you know, I think that in many ways it means as much to him as it does to me. And I think, you know, that the camaraderie between the two of us, or the emotional exchange between the two of us, I think was simply an expression of what many, many people were feeling. And it was amazing to know that the team was going to stay, because as we worked through the prior season, you know, I'm kind of figuring out, you know, I'm a husband and I'm a father, and I've got kids in school, and, you know, there's only so many teams in the league. It wasn't like we could just pull up roots and, you know, move someplace else if there was even an opening. So, you know, there was a little bit of that on the personal level, but I think it was just a sense of emotion. We're around people leading up to the season opener and the things they were saying and the positive feelings about what was happening. And I think maybe it just sort of manifested itself to some degree between the two of us.
And now, of course, as we've already stated, the Haslams have come over from Cleveland. They own the Browns. Now they're owners of the Columbus Crew. I mean, what does it say about the Haslam family that they have come in, they've stepped in, and I've heard they've spoken with, of course, you know, the owners of the Atlanta Falcons, Atlanta United, and to yeah. get their perspective on to say, you know what, it doesn't hurt to own a team in MLS because it'll be a big, big thing, and you'll be, you know, in everyone's debt forever. What was that like?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I don't think there's any doubt that in recent years, this influx of the NFL, which has arguably for some time now been, you know, the most successful professional sports league in this country. So when an NFL owner speaks in those circles, it does carry a lot of weight. The less well-known piece of the Haslam family is that it was Mrs. Haslam that first started the ball rolling. She heard about research on it. But, of course, she was thinking about it in context of what had happened in Cleveland with the Browns moving to Baltimore. And pretty much said to her husband, you know, we really shouldn't let this happen if we can. If we can help keep the team, we really need to do this. And that's what got the ball rolling. And then, yeah, within the NFL, you know, fraternity, then they start talking. It's no different than what Charlotte, you know, is coming in now and getting these people. But, the Falcons, Arthur Blank, you know, so proactive about the league. Another little-known story, and I won't give all the details for time, but Jim Smith, who was an Ohio State grad, went on to be an associate athletic director at Ohio State and eventually became the GM and finally president of the Crew, left Columbus to take a job with the Atlanta Falcons. And was with them and heavily involved in the new stadium, but also when they started talking about joining MLS, and while Jim wasn't really interested in going, he was comfortable where he was very much behind the scenes in the meetings, advising them because he had the experience. And so then that sort of boomerang back to the Haslams and played a part in ultimately them settling to keep the team in Columbus. And there was a lot of interaction with Jim as well. So the fact that the Haslam family was A, open to the concept, and then B, was very welcoming to lots of sources of information. Pete Edwards, who's, you know, he was the team doctor for 24 years and now is the, you know, along with the Haslams, the majority owners, he told me he went to have breakfast. He was introduced to Haslams and met up for a breakfast meeting. He said by the time that meeting was over, he knew that they were the right people to bring on board, and then it was simply a matter of could they put the financing and the things that the league wanted in a timely fashion, and you know they were allowed to do it. So to go from the Hunt family and now the Haslam family, even though they've been beaten up a lot about some things with the Cleveland Browns these days, I think that their connection to the community and the fact that they put so much value into the organization and the connection to the community, it can't be overstated in importance.
As you've already stated, that new stadium for the Crew is being built in downtown Columbus. Obviously, that whole section of a Nationwide Arena for the NHL's Columbus Blue Jackets, Huntington Ballpark, the AAA affiliate of the Cleveland Indians, the Columbus Clippers, of course, formerly the Yankees AAA affiliate. I'm a Yankee fan and I can't help it. and then, of course, the brand new Columbus Crew Stadium being constructed over there. Have you been amazed at the progression of sports in downtown Columbus and how much it's grown to, like, you've had a minor league baseball stadium, you know, in the outskirts of downtown Columbus. Same thing with Crew Stadium, because it's been in the Ohio State Fairground area as well. I mean, just to see it all come together, do you think that new stadium for the Columbus Crew in downtown Columbus is like the cherry on top of the cake?
Well, at this point in time, I would say yes, because it's hard to imagine what else with the Reds and Bengals in Cincinnati, the Browns and Indians in Cleveland, plus you've got the Cavs up there. You know, it's hard to imagine, and that has a lot to do with how the Crew and then the Blue Jackets ended up in Columbus, which because as the city of Columbus grew, they knew that while it was always going to be an Ohio State town, and it's still Ohio State football first, but that they could coexist, there could be other things, and how can we get that? And most people don't realize that in terms of city population, Columbus is the 13th largest city in the country. And Indianapolis is right behind it. San Francisco is right in front of them. So it's a much bigger, but if you come here, you don't notice it because it's traditional, as I said, traditional Midwestern. People live outside, in the suburbs. They go into the city to work, then they go home. Well, that's all changed now. So you've got within this region, the arena, the stadium that you were talking about, now the new stadium, and then there's going to be business development, there's going to be housing, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's going along with this development that was part of it. And, you know, while the city was ultimately incredibly cooperative, they also knew that they needed to do more than just add another athletic facility. They needed to broaden their horizons. And now you've got sections of Columbus both downtown proper, the German Village, Italian Village, Victorian Village, as they're called here. You've got all of these within city limits communities, and now they're going to restaurants and nightclubs and doing their entertainment stuff, and now they've got all their sports. They're going to be in the same place. I think any city in the country outside of a New York or, you know, Chicago would welcome this. The designs for the stadium and their interest in coming up with new, unique pieces, unique elements to make it a little bit different is spectacular. So I think that Columbus, Ohio has found its niche, and it's filling it really well.
As we finish up this interview, and first of all, thank you once again for joining me tonight, because, you know, you are one of those original broadcasters that started this league here for like 25 years. And, you know, if you ever met an aspiring broadcaster, whether it be in television or radio or, you know, calling the games, analyzing the games, or being a sideline reporter, even pregame, postgame, what would you say to those people that want to get into this genre? And at the same time, do they want to broadcast soccer, be an important soccer broadcaster? What would you say to them?
I always say what I'm asked this, no matter what the opportunity is, never say no. Never think that you are bigger than the job. You have no idea what one might lead to the next. And if you go and you're fully committed and you demonstrate that it doesn't matter, you're going to do what's asked of you to the best of your ability. That's going to create opportunities. Obviously, in the broadcast world, there's a certain level of talent required to be able to do on the TV side, to be able to do play-by-play or to be the analyst. And you're trying to draw things, and you've got a producer talking, and there's a lot going on. So, no, not everybody can do it successfully. But first and foremost, never be too big for the opportunity that's presented itself. And then on the TV side specifically, because even today radio is still a bit different, on the TV side, while you're the one on camera, while you're the voice they hear during the course of the game, there are so many more people that are part of that broadcast that you don't have a broadcast without them. And to remember that we're just people, we're all here to do a job. And while ours is the quote-unquote marquee piece because we're the face of the voice, without the cameraman, without the technical people, without the stage manager, without all those ancillary parts doing their job, it doesn't matter because I'll never get to do my job. And I've always tried to remember that, to be respectful of that. You know, Bill McDermott, you mentioned him earlier. Bill was always one of those guys, right? I mean, he was always acknowledging the support around. And those are the two pieces of advice I would give. Never be too big for a job, and never forget that you're just one part of the machine.
Favorite Columbus Crew player to call a goal for, and favorite visiting player to call a goal for against the Crew?
Wow. I guess it would have to be for the Crew, Stern John, who, had he stayed in MLS, was scoring at a clip where he probably would have had about 400 goals in 3 years. I mean, the dude just everything. But at that time, so they started off with a shootout at the end of tie games. But then there was a period of time when not only was there no overtime, but the clock was on the scoreboard. And he literally hit a buzzer winner. You know, you imagine. Because in soccer, the ball's got to be across the line.
Mm-hmm.
And he hit a shot from the top of the box that went into the back of the net as the horn sounded to win the game. It's one of them, you know, you just don't see that in soccer, right?
Right.
And that's why that one sticks out. The visiting one is easy. It's Marcelo Balboa's bicycle kick, which is everybody's seen. It's out there everywhere. It's one of the greatest goals in league history. I mean, you're talking a full-on bicycle kick, and they ended up winning the game.
I had him on my show. He didn't remember doing it because he got concussed.
Yeah, I was saying, because he landed on his head, yeah.
How is that possible? I don't know.
for those who haven't seen it, you just put it in Marcelo Balboa bicycle kick and you'll find it. I mean, it's an incredible goal.
Yeah.
And how high he gets and the rest of it. But he's a great guy. That's been real fun. You know, Brian McBride, I'll give you a quick example. We were out in San Jose. We always went out an extra day early to the West Coast. And while the team did everything on the bus, I had a car because I had different timing and responsibilities and things. So he wanted to go up to Palo Alto to take care of something at Stanford or somebody he knew. I don't recall off the top of my head what the reason was, but he said, "Could you give me a ride?" I said, "Sure." So, you know, you're just driving up there, and then we get into Palo Alto, and we stop to get something to drink, and, you know, people are pointing at it. You know, the whole it's Brian McBride thing. But you would have never known that, and I'm just kind of thinking to myself, you know, here's a Derek Jeter, since you're a Yankees guy.
That's true.
And I'm just walking around with him because he's just another human being, you know? But one of the things I'll never forget, he said to me, he said, "You know, Dwight, Columbus is one of those cities where nobody thinks they want to go there. But once they do, they never want to leave." And the only reason when he came back from England that he went to Chicago is because he was now married, had kids, and they were in school and whatnot, and he felt that that stability was important. But this is a guy in the early days of the league. He'd wander around town, and he'd always take a picture. He always had time for people. So whether it's Marcelo Balboa, or I got to know John Hux pretty well, Brad Friedel, I talk to all the time, you know, and they're just guys. And they're just people that I encountered along the way. And they're just part of the many memories and the opportunities. I got to call World Cup games because they were looking for people that knew soccer. I've done tons of U.S. Open Cup games for multiple teams, you know, in New Orleans and in Rochester and in Virginia. But, you know, the experiences that I've had and the opportunities it's opened up for me are more than any one person deserves.
Yeah. That's absolutely right. Dwight, listen, thank you so much for coming on the show tonight. I really do appreciate it. Thank you very much for your 25 years of service calling the Columbus Crew and calling MLS. It's really a wonderful moment to share this with you. And thank you very much for giving the audience, including some of those that support the Columbus Crew, to hear your voice. And good luck for your future endeavors. And hopefully you will come back and whether it be calling the crew on the games or maybe being a pregame host or whatever it is, I hope you do come back for another again. But thank you so much for the time, and I really do appreciate it.
You are welcome. It's my privilege. I'm so grateful you asked.
Thank you.
All right, take care.
You do too. Bye-bye. And that is Dwight Burgess, formerly the play-by-play voice of the Columbus Crew. And, you know, it's just wonderful to talk about these things with this gentleman. And, you know, these are the people that help start the league locally. You have to give them a chance to share their wonderful stories, being a part of one team for the entire career of calling professional soccer in Columbus, Ohio. Apologies for not having the phone lines working to connect, but thankfully we're able to get him on, and it's just a wonderful thing to have that man on. Now, just to remind everybody, the next show will be this coming Wednesday. I'm going to have on Thomas Rongen, former head coach of the Tampa Bay Mutiny, DC United, of course, analyst on DC United games and other broadcast levels, including BN Sports. He'll be joining me about his coaching career in MLS, and it should be a lot of fun, and I cannot wait to talk to him about his time in MLS. But once again, thank you to Dwight Burgess, the former play-by-play voice of the Columbus Crew on television. My name's Daniel Fourier. You can join me again this coming Wednesday, and then next Monday, as we're going to have on the head coach of the Houston Dynamo and the former U.S. Men's National Team midfield attacker and former Metro Star Hall of Famer, Tob Ramos. Good night. Take care. So long. And bye-bye for now. And as always, please enjoy your football. Be careful. Be safe. Have a good night. Bye-bye for now.